It's great to welcome Glenn Surowiec of GDS Investments to this conversation. I'm using the term great loosely here because it's been an absolutely brutal time in the markets. We're recording this on March the 12th, and as we've seen, things change by the hour. So we really are going through another very, very unusual time. In some ways, very similar to 2008, but in a lot of ways, very, very different as well. And Glenn, when we talked last, just a couple of months ago, you did talk about basically a major inflection point that might be ahead. And that was very prescient. Talk, and now we're seeing all kinds of dislocations and long-term opportunities as well. And today I'd like to talk to you about mainly the energy sector that was kind of a
Sure.
beaten up sector going into this and now is just completely devastated. And for those who do have some firepower, I think something to look at. So why don't I turn it to you and you can kind of give me your assessment of where we are.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I think the market was starting to discount the fact that coronavirus was moving kind of beyond its origin and, into Europe and, certainly into the United States. The last couple of weeks of February were difficult, and obviously we've just seen a continuation of that, with certainly a pickup in the magnitude of the downturn. I think there's several things that the market is certainly trying to digest. I think from a policy standpoint, I think we are, we're sort of moving from originally a state of denial to, taking very, very drastic measures here. And I'm sure you're experiencing that where you are in Switzerland. Layered on top of that, specifically as relates to the energy sector, is, I think there's been, a level of cooperation between, OPEC plus, really since the last downturn in 2016. And I think the expectation when they met on Friday was that lower prices would be met with production cuts. And that's sort of the playbook that OPEC has used in previous downturns. And so not only did that not happen, as I think Russia has different plans for how to deal with the current environment, but then Saudi Arabia over the weekend announced price cuts to various customers and an increase in their production. And so I think from a high level, so you have to understand that, although they're sort of quasi connected through this global, network and OPEC and, at the end of the day, they come from very different places. And so there's an element of self-preservation involved here where, they in some ways they do and they don't have the ability to absorb large losses depending on kind of what metric you pull into the discussion. Saudi Arabia needs somewhere around $80 because of their bloated budget. They certainly have a higher dependency on oil prices, but they both have the ability to extract oil. Marginal cost is very, very low. Russia over the last several years has lowered their break-even point from a budgetary standpoint to around $42. They've taken expenses out. They have substantial reserves, and it seems as though that they've indicated to the market that they're willing to use that to kind of keep their own economy functioning. Saudi Arabia, on the other hand, again, talked about, big budget problem. But at the same time, they're debt to GDP ratio is low enough that, you know, they could potentially plug the gap by borrowing if need be. So that, I think that kind of sets the stage. And I think the spillover effect is what you would expect. I mean, if you're a high cost leverage producer, and I say that with an eye on, you know, some production here, mainly shale, you know, I obviously that's an area that's going to be impacted. It's going to be impacted right away. And you know, I'm not sure I'm comfortable owning that debt, let alone the equity. And what I've tried to do, and maybe later on I'll get into like a name, but I think just kind of conceptually speaking, I think the parallel that works for me is probably the financials, and you can kind of pick a period, whether it's, you know, 08, 09, or even 11 or 12 when there was that second downdraft, where, you know, for the most part, you have, these are leveraged businesses, there is a commodity component. And what I tried to do is try to take the ones that are most sort of insulated from a balance sheet perspective, and companies that have a very long track record of navigating, you know, lots of different cycles. And, you know, I think I'm not, you know, certainly not an expert in, you know, I cover a lot of different industries, and I'm more an opportunist in terms of how I invest. And but I, you know, I'm pretty mindful that if you have a particular industry that's very, very hard hit, it's probably worth getting closer to. And so now that oil trades for, you know, $30 a barrel, and the headlines are, you know, very, very concerning, and the energy sector, you know, a sector that traditionally is, you know, probably in the high single digits in terms of S&P 500 weighting, where now it's like around 3%. And I know we've talked before, and that's something I always look at to identify pockets of under and overvaluation. I think it's important if there's a sector that seems to be maybe well above mean or well below mean, I think at a minimum, I want to understand why. And then you just kind of look at the supply chain, and, you know, you can go from the fully integrated companies to the pure play producers, to even the refiners, to the, you know, to the service companies, and you identify the top two or three businesses within those, and you know, without exception, they're all at 15-year lows. So I think that's what sort of, it's sort of those factors that led me to kind of say, all right, kind of what's happening here. Do I think there's an opportunity to invest? I think the answer is yes. Can you do it blindly? The answer is no. I think that there's an element of volatility. So I think you need to double down on certain principles. I think the number one principle is patience. I think that people, if they're looking to, you know, just, you have to accept a recovery outside of the normal V-shaped recovery in terms of prices. I mean, the oil is a tricky kind of commodity to handicap, but there are some laws in economics to suggest that when prices get so low, you know, there's certain behavior that ensues, and that behavior will ultimately lead to, you know, some restoration in, you know, margins and profitability, which in turn will work to restore prices to some, you know, level that makes more economic sense. And the corollary obviously is in high prices, you sort of have the opposite factors. But does it require patience? Yes. Does it require a careful study of which companies are going to be around when the cycle improves? I think the answer is certainly yes. And I kind of have a playbook that I use. I'm not saying that this is everyone's kind of wired differently. So use a playbook that, you know, allows you to succeed in the long term. My playbook is, and this isn't, you know, this isn't necessarily something that applies just to the energy business. I think in general, when you're dealing with cyclical companies, it's really kind of, it's really important to kind of capture a lot of what I'm about to say. Number one, how safe is the dividend? Very easy to look at, right? You can look at just kind of taking a snapshot of where they are. You can look at, you know, the income statement, look at certain metrics from the cash flow statement. You can look at the balance sheet, but you can also look at kind of how they behaved in previous cycles. There are companies in every cyclical business that are, you know, the price sort of guides them, and it doesn't guide them in an opportunistic way. It sort of guides them in sort of a preservation way, where prices go down, they're sort of, you know, they're sort of swimming naked, the tide goes out, and, you know, they're forced to, you know, get defensive very, very quickly. They cut CapEx, they cut the dividend, and I, you know, I hate highlighting names sort of here on the downside, but just, you know, one company that kind of got caught flat-footed, which is a very, very big, big company, is Oxy, you know. And, you know, they went out and outbid Chevron last year for Anadarko. They took on a lot of debt relative to their enterprise value. And then they borrowed $10 billion in preferred stock at 8% to Berkshire. So great deal for Berkshire. In hindsight, maybe not such a great deal for Oxy. I think Carl Icahn recently has increased his position, and he sort of highlighted that. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, you should be suspicious when you're a smaller company and you have a company like Chevron and you're outbidding Chevron and you're swallowing a very, very big company and you're using leverage to do it and you're in a cyclical business. That is not a formula I am willing to, you know, get behind. So to the extent there's a dividend, and to the extent that you feel like it's going to be cut, I my personal preference is to wait until after it's cut, even though the expectation might be there, because I do think that there's a lag between when old shareholders exit, mainly shareholders that are very yield sensitive, and when they can now develop a different shareholder base that maybe is kind of a hybrid of, hey, we want to take advantage of a distressed equity, and we're playing for a recovery, and, you know, the yield is sort of a perk as opposed to the, you know, the basis behind the investment. The second thing I look for is low cost production. You know, obviously the laws within any cyclical and commodity businesses is that, you know, if things get very, very tough and prolonged, the low cost producer ultimately will win. So find companies that have access to low cost production. I want to identify kind of where we are in the capital cycle. And so I think what we have seen over the last month, and really getting very pronounced in the last week after, you know, what happened last Friday and over the weekend related to OPEC, is that companies are getting very aggressive with cutting down CapEx. And so that, I'm not saying I want to invest in companies that are doing that, but I certainly want to be mindful of where industry supply is, knowing that that'll eventually, you know, within the oil market, supply comes down, there's a certain amount of depletion, and it's really the supply side of the equation that you really want to follow more than demand. Demand can kind of stay relatively stable absent a coronavirus shock. But in a normal environment, even in a recession, you don't see wide fluctuations in demand. So supply tends to be a big driver behind pricing, where that equilibrium price is. You know, looking at the asset base, obviously that kind of ties into, you know, the financial analysis that I got into before. Here's the reality. There's a lot of companies that are very reluctant to identify holes in their balance sheet. And, you know, the debt is obviously, you know, going to hold up, as I think Buffett once said. where the assets are the ones that are at risk. And, you know, a lot of those assets, if they're at risk, in turn, might drive certain covenants that are tied to, you know, different balance sheet ratios or different, you know, debt to EBITDA ratios and things of that sort. So you want a management team that you trust that has been through these cycles before and isn't, you know, overly optimistic about, you know, maybe requiring a quick rebound in prices. And so how should investors play this? Well, I think what I've tried to do is, and again, I think there's certain, if you're focused on energy and you're talking to, you know, 20 different companies a week, and that's kind of your expertise, then you might have some insight that I don't. I mean, a company that I've always admired is Exxon. And so I think for the average investor that is more of a generalist that wants exposure, you can do it through an ETF. You know, XLE kind of stands out, you know, but if you look under the hood of XLE, you're essentially 40% of it is Exxon and Chevron. So it's not bad, right? So you have two sort of domestic, fully integrated companies, you know, that have been around for a long period of time. And the rest is sort of filled with companies that are a little more focused on one area of the supply chain, whether it's Schlumberger or Kinder Morgan or, you know, companies of that sort. But what I like about Exxon is that they have a very, very long history of operating in a way that captures the entire commodity cycle. So their capital spending doesn't necessarily get too up or too down depending upon where we are. And, you know, because they're very much focused on the long-term economics of the project. So, you know, I like that because it allows them to potentially tilt in a different direction than the industry. And as a value investor, obviously that concept resonates with me. And to the extent that they're doing things opportunistically, and they're doing it in an industry that can't, then I think coming out the other side, you know, they go from strong to stronger. So that appeals to me. I mean, certainly if you look at their dividend history, they don't cut dividends. And, you know, I've certainly looked at their behavior in previous downturns. You know, you can go back to 2016. They did not cut their dividend. And if you go back to 2008 and 2009, so their dividend in 2007 was $1.37. And then in 2008, it was $1.55. In 2009, it was $1.66. And I think this year they're expecting $3.43. So, and again, so there's a level of discipline and long-term thinking that kind of goes into their capital allocation policy. I like that. I think others will argue, well, if you take a snapshot of kind of where they are from cash flow from ops, and if you kind of look at CapEx, you know, they might need to borrow some money to fund some of the $15 billion coming out. And the answer to that is maybe. They do have other levers that they can pull potentially with CapEx and other things. But I think they've sort of built the balance sheet from a debt to total capital perspective. So they're much lower than the industry. They've always, you know, they got a AAA balance sheet, and they've kind of prided themselves on flexing it when they need to, and then flexing it down, maybe when others are expanding their balance sheet. And so I'm actually okay, with them doing that. Obviously, there's limits to how far they can do that, but I think they've earned the right to do that, and I think that they have, you know, they certainly have my trust, and I think at $39 and an 8% yield, that's where I would be starting.
So, Glenn, just on Exxon, can you talk a little bit more about the sensitivity of those numbers or some of those numbers to the oil price? You know, what? How should we think about the earnings impact?
Well, they're fully integrated. So, I mean, in terms of oil, I think Exxon has put out there that they can make money still in the low 30s. I think Exxon has always prided itself on, I don't know that I would play it on near-term earnings. I think, you know, certainly 2009 will go down, you know, commensurate with, you know, the downturn in, you know, not only pricing, but just, you know, just production activity potentially related to a weakening economy. And certainly there's disruption in you know, what's happening globally related to the coronavirus. They had an investor day 2 weeks ago, and don't quote me on this, but I'm sort of, you know, close plus or minus 5%. But I think they were expecting, you know, cash from ops somewhere around $35 billion and CapEx on the low end at $30 billion. And a dividend that's somewhere around $15 billion. And I think there's, you know, I don't want to go out there and say Exxon will never cut their dividend. I'm just saying I don't believe it's in their DNA. And I don't think that they're a company that kind of operates the way that, you know, they're, I think the energy industry has its share of aggressive personalities. And, you know, people that probably get more aggressive when prices go up, and they get very acquisitive and they get very happy, and they, in turn, they build businesses that get very bloated. Exxon doesn't have that reputation. And, you know, I spent considerable amount of time in Texas, and I know a lot of Exxon just has a reputation that is just very conservative in projects they pursue, in how they hire, in the kinds of people they look for from a finance perspective and from an engineering perspective. And it pretty much, you know, permeates their entire company. And so, you know, I here's what I look at. I look at the wherewithal to ride out a prolonged down cycle. And I look at their history with previous downturns. You know, mainly, are they quick to cut the dividend? And the answer is no. And then, if, you know, the oil market has a way of, you know, sort of coming back a lot quicker than people expect. And it also has a way of collapsing quicker than people expect. And so, you know, I think the last time we were here was in late 2015, early 2016, you know, when prices were in the mid to low 30s. And, you know, then they bounced relatively quickly, you know, by the end of the year to the high 50s, and then, you know, bounced around a little bit. And then we saw a spike about a year and a half ago. And so, you know, and even coming out of the, you know, that great recession in 2008, where, you know, if you can think back to the headlines, I mean, oil went in at 160, and, you know, within half a year, it was, down to, the low 50s. Now, obviously, a lot happened between December 2007 and January 2009. I get that. But the corollary is that, within a short period of time, it was back up over $100. So I think that there are certain factors within the oil market where volatility cuts both ways. And so it's difficult for me to see like a very, very prolonged environment. Now, what you're getting with Exxon is downside protection. What you're not getting is, to the extent that I'm right, that things do snap back, and it's quicker. The continentals of the world will go up 3 or 4x relatively quickly. It's not like how companies came out of the financial crisis. I mean, there is some symmetry with, how deep the downturn is with how robust the recovery is. And so, oil isn't different from that. And but at the same time, I do think, similar to maybe buying Wells Fargo at $10 or maybe even Bank of America or even JP Morgan or companies like that, JP Morgan, was at $30 after the London whale crisis. And, this is after 2008 and 2009, and it's, still up three and a half fold. And so I think it's that kind of investment. It's not a 10 bagger. But I do think conservatively it could be up, two and a half times over a 3 year period.
Well, thank you for that case. Just one question on the big picture, and then we can turn to specifics again. But I don't really understand why we're getting this price war now when oil is already going to be under pressure given what's happening in the world. How can it be in the interest of anyone to actually have this kind of a price war at this time?
Well, I guess my thought is that if you're Russia, I think there is some, I think they feel from a market share standpoint that there are some players in the industry, some high cost producers. It's very Darwinistic. I mean, at the end of the day, I think that there's a lot of producers that shouldn't be around, and that I think that they want to kill. I mean, to kind of put it mildly. And I believe that they are willing to absorb the short-term pain. I think they've sort of built themselves to live in a low oil world. And I think they've done a lot of things from a budgetary standpoint over the last 4 years. But yet they feel that shale has, just maybe stepped on their turf a little bit. And so I think in some ways, I think Russia's position has less to do with Saudi Arabia and more to do with some of the domestic producers that are, have a very high cost structure in the U.S. I mean, the U.S. is the number one producer, and there's some decent production, and then there's some not so great production from a cost standpoint. So, to the extent they could wipe that out, I think that would be in their long-term best interest. And to the extent that they have the budget set up for it and they have the reserves to do that, I think that that's in their long-term best interest. And I'm not sure Russia necessarily bought into the Saudi argument that the production cut would have, they almost probably thought of it as a Band-Aid solution, where you're kind of kicking the can down the road especially if you feel that there's a recession kind of looming. And, you know, that in turn will put pressure on prices. But I don't know that I disagree with the spirit of your question. I think the spirit of your question is, you know, at the end of the day, there's you know, eventually money talks. And so, you know, I think that that'll certainly grease the wheels for some sort of compromise. You know, the Saudis need to sell oil. I don't, you know, they're not in a position where they can drink it. So, you know, I think that they're certainly extremely levered to oil prices in a way that other countries aren't. They can extract it very inexpensively, but they haven't really built, you know, they have this huge sort of like 2030 vision. They have huge spending plans. They have huge other things. And so something has to give. And they either need to bring down their break-even level, or they need to expand their balance sheet and, you know, leverage the fact that their debt to GDP ratio is 25%. And they need to borrow money to plug the gap between revenues and expenses. I think you kind of have some rogue players here. I mean, I think as much as in the 70s when OPEC controlled, you know, 50% ish of the oil market, and to the extent, you know, culturally a lot of those countries were very aligned, you know, I think the world order has changed, and I don't know that Russia is particularly aligned with Saudi, at least lockstep, in that, you know, Saudi Arabia can walk into a meeting and say, hey, here's what we're thinking about doing, and, you know, Russia's just going to nod their head and say, okay, you know, I think there's other things in play here, both economically and politically. So I think that nothing would make Russia happier other than to inflict some pain on high-cost U.S. producers.
Right. I guess where I'm coming from, just historically, it's generally been a good thing for countries that produce oil that are net exporters to have a high price of oil. Helps their currencies, helps everything. But I definitely see the argument on inflicting pain on your competition. In the U.S., the question, I guess, is now whether the U.S. will recognize that and then provide some sort of stimulus to that shale industry to tie them over through this period.
Well, that's an interesting question. And I find it strange that Harold Hamm is going on different TV stations asking for. I think you know, this is sort of like a moment out of The Godfather, where, you know, I think the administration needs to look at Harold Hamm and say, this is a business that you chose, as Hyman Roth did to Michael Corleone. And, you know, this is the reality. I mean, no one forced them into this business, and so they can't have it both ways. I mean, I think that if you want to be in a business where you're a high-cost producer and you want to take on leverage, then unfortunately you should deal with the consequences.
Right, absolutely.
I come at this from an economic standpoint and a capitalist, not necessarily from a political standpoint. So the politics will say something different. But I can assure you that will hurt Trump's ability to get reelected if he starts throwing different. So it's a different situation, right? Because if you're an airline, and the airlines, by the way, haven't asked for help, and they're cutting all kinds of capacity, and in some ways, to their credit, they've sort of built up a liquidity chest for this moment. There was a lot of air, and I have a ton of respect for, you know, Doug Parker and a lot of these guys, but, you know, for the airline industry. And they on Tuesday, there was an investor conference. I think it was Morgan Stanley, but don't hold me to that. And they were very candid about the industry and kind of what they've done and all the liquidity they've raised and just, you know, there's a plan in place. And this is something that was very unexpected. In other words, the level, you know, when you're dealing with a coronavirus, it's similar to dealing with a Katrina, but on a global scale. It's like, okay, yeah, I understand natural disasters, but, you know, the idea that, like, a city can be shut down and not need aid is obviously, you know, not on the table. Well, you know, there's certain industries that, you know, you can plan for certain things, but are you really planning for 9/11? And in some ways they have, but it all comes down to how deep, right? I mean, if you're going to take drastic measures, great, then we're going to solve this, you know, similar in a way that like other countries have once they went from denial to taking very drastic measures. But in the case of shale production, I don't know that my sympathy extends quite there. I'm sorry. You know, they were in a business, they took on leverage, and the commodity cycle is not something that should catch them off guard. And, you know, unfortunately, it's a business that lives really, really well at certain prices, and it doesn't at other prices. But if you look at the oil curve and you model out their business, we've been here before, and this is like a once every 5 year thing. And, you know, so if you were modeling a once every generation or two event that historically has occurred much more frequently, then shame on you.
Well, I guess purely from a capitalist standpoint, this should probably be the time when companies like Exxon choose to step up or not, and they have their pick of assets from companies that did over leverage.
I would hope that the Exxons and the Berkshires of the world, similar to certainly what Berkshire did in 2008, 2009. I think it would be terrific for the system, the capitalist system, to solve this problem. And I think with financials, I think you're dealing with, you know, an industry that's much more fragile and much more integrated and impacts every industry. And so you really did need a government solution to kind of come in there. I mean, if you know, people aren't able to issue commercial paper, then, you know, obviously that's a problem. And if, you know, the money market accounts are breaking the buck, obviously that's a problem. And but with the oil industry, yeah, I think you have companies that are sound and are opportunistic and have very, very deep resources and very smart people in their corporate development department, and are, you know, firing up their Excel spreadsheet as we speak.
Absolutely. Glenn, I'm wondering whether you have any takes on some of the smaller companies in the space, perhaps not even just E&P, but kind of tangential energy services or even tankers or anything like that. There's a lot of companies there that used to be value darlings or darlings of well-known investors, and they've absolutely gotten hammered. Have you looked at any of those? Do you have a take?
So my take is life is too short, and I'm not looking to be overly heroic here. I guess I'm looking to jump over the proverbial 1 foot hurdle. But with that said, I'm not oblivious to what's happening with some of the service companies, whether Schlumberger or Halliburton. Schlumberger is a world-class business. Those businesses typically operate with a lag. And so I think it comes down to, sort of tolerance for pain and ability to further concentrate. And yeah, if you have a long-term horizon, and if you have a high emotional IQ, and if you can maybe just sort of just stay within yourself. I am giving people permission to take a look at Schlumberger at $16. I think Schlumberger will be around. I think it's very respected. I think it's global, and I think it's on the short list of companies that can provide services to these big, fully integrated companies that I've mentioned. But the caveat is the recovery might take a little bit longer. That may already be priced in, given the fact that Exxon, in the last couple of weeks has gone from 60 to 40, and Schlumberger has gone from 40 to 16. So a lot of this may or may not be relevant, but if you're going to move up and down the supply chain, I guess what I would do is get back to some of my earlier points about balance sheet, market leadership, strong management teams. And if you have the checklist out and Schlumberger checks a lot of those boxes, then that's probably a company you want to get closer to.
And what's the latest number on the energy sector as a percentage of the S&P? I mean, we got to be close to a low.
I am trying to detach myself from the day-to-day movements, but I believe we're around 3.
Wow. That's a really low.
We talked about this before, and I'm not, there's no, I think if you, what I like about looking at sector weightings is that you can kind of reverse engineer in hindsight, because you know what happened, right? So you go back to every bubble, go back to every period where you had a particular sector do really well over a decade. And, bubbles originate from above mean levels, and, great 10-year periods originate from below mean levels. It just the way it is. And it should make sense. It makes sense to me. And you have a wonderful group of listeners, and I'm sure it makes sense to them. But it's something that is at least easy, because you can kind of dig in there. And then what I like about it is that, okay, after you've identified the 11 sectors and said, okay, I'm going to pass on here, I'm going to look at here, then you can start looking at the subsectors and find the leaders. And then, you know, that I would start kind of from there, but it allows you to at least, you know, it gives you a starting spot for identifying extreme pockets of undervaluation.
Absolutely. Well, Glenn, this has been very helpful perspective in this very unusual time. You have any closing thoughts before we wrap it up?
I don't. I certainly appreciate the conversation, and it's been helpful on a lot of different levels just to kind of, you know, get this out there and you know, talk to someone else who's thoughtful and who has kind of studied things. I think the one lasting comment I'll make is let's not get too myopic here. Let's not panic. You know, let's sort of take a step back and, you know, kind of compare this cycle to previous recessions, corrections, however you want to characterize this. And, you know, I think the beauty of this business is that when you can sit here and think how returns are going to look in 1, 2, or 3 years, if you're going to spend time thinking about, you know, not necessarily today or tomorrow or next week, spend time thinking about 2021, 2022, 2023. Because mathematically, that's really where the value of the business is. It's in those later years, and it's really, you know, much later and almost the terminal value years. And so, you know, don't overcomplicate things. Think long term. And I think that we will come out of you know, this chaotic period the way that we have in every other period, where I think in a year or two, I think people are going to come out okay. So I'll sort of leave everybody with those very, very comforting projections.
Well, those are certainly words that are good to hear at the moment. Always a pleasure to connect, and I really appreciate you taking the time on short notice to come on and share your thoughts here. This really is the time to do a lot of thinking, a lot of looking, and you know, at times like these, while scary, can actually end up being opportunities or times of opportunity. And I think we're trying to see whether we can actually make that a reality by being thoughtful and not panicking, as you say, but actually looking at this rationally and trying to take a longer view. Glenn, thank you so much. Truly appreciate your time and insights.
No, thank you, John. My pleasure.
Goodbye for now.
Goodbye.